In our studies thus far, we are simply laying a groundwork for the things that we're going to be building on as our studies continue. And so if you would please turn in your lesson book to lesson number 2, page number 5, and we'll continue the things that we're talking about as we identify the land that we're going to be studying about just a little bit later on. In our study, we're trying to identify the size of the land that is referred to as the land of Palestine, the land of Canaan, and so forth. In our lesson book, we've learned that from Dan to Beersheba is about 150 miles. We have used those terms to identify the extent of the land for the most part. We know that according to Genesis chapter 15, the land was promised unto Abram to extend from the great river, the river Euphrates, unto the river of Egypt on the south. That would extend it a little bit farther than the 150 miles. But this gives us the general idea of the land that we're studying about. Monica, I don't know if you all have a lesson book on this subject that we're studying, history and geography of the Bible. I think it's a fascinating study. Some of you who have one, if you wouldn't mind to share with Dustin and Monica, it would be helpful to them to be able to see the things that we're talking about, most of which are on the chart up here. But we're going to be studying those things in some detail for the next several months. As we look at the size of the land, we talk about the Mediterranean Sea. It's only 30 miles from the Mediterranean Sea to the River Jordan. And as we look at the southern portion of the land, from Gaza, which was about 3 miles inland, we'll talk about that perhaps a little later in our study this morning, over to the Dead Sea was about 50 miles. So we're not looking at a very large land. I think in our studies previously, we saw the nation of Palestine as it is depicted in various states of the United States. And so it's not very big. It's just a tiny little place. But we're going to see why it was so strategically important in Bible history, and for that matter, in world history. The term Canaan came to be used to that area that was on the west side of the river of Jordan. Now, transportation in a small place. We think that going 150 miles is nothing. And in an automobile, it's probably nothing. But suppose you were traveling with a caravan of camels. If you had all the equipment and the things necessary to trade, it would take you about 5 days to travel 150 miles. Or if you were traveling by camel, it would take you about 2 days. If you were traveling walking, as herdsmen were, with a flock of sheep, it would take you about 2 weeks. Now, though this was a little land, it would depend on what you were doing and how you were traveling as to whether or not it was considered big or little. Now, I've got another map I want you to look at, but as we look at the location of the land of Palestine, it was very strategically located. It connected the two continents of Asia and Africa. From the east to the west, it connected the Mediterranean Sea with the Arabian Desert. Now, if anywhere you traveled, north, south, east, or west, you had to go through this land, the land of Canaan, would you be aware of the God of the people of Israel? Go like this. You would, because the God of these people would be impressed upon you, not only because of the faith that they had or didn't have, but because of your interaction with those people, you very well may become an enemy and be the object of God's wrath. Now, suppose you're the people of Israel who were very disobedient. We know on occasion that God used other nations to destroy them. We've already looked at the maps where the king of Assyria came down according to the promise of God unto the kings and told them that the Assyrians would take them captive, which in the year 722 they did. We see that the Babylonians then conquered the Assyrians and conquered the city of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. The prophets tell us of these things. So not only were those who were the neighbors of Israel who warred with them, subject to the wrath of God, but often the people of God were subject to the wrath of God through the punishment of the nations round about them. Now, as you look on this particular map, these trade routes are identified as they are in your lesson book. Trade routes. What's the importance of a trade route, Randy? Yeah, why is that so significant, and particularly in this country? Well, that's right. We're going to talk about some of these cities, such as Tyre and Sidon, that became import-export cities, and they exported across the Mediterranean Sea. So to travel up and down in this country was essential to livelihood, not only of the people of God, but those who were the neighbors of the people of God. Located on this map and in your lesson book, I want you to be well familiar with these trade routes. The way of Shur, or the way of the sea, as you see this route that goes along the coast. And then the way of Shur that goes up through the high country of the land of Palestine, or the land of Canaan. And then you have the hill country that's identified on this map, the way of Shur. And then you have identified on this map the King's Highway, which was on the east side of the Jordan Valley. Now somebody might say, well, why is that so significant? Wars were fought to control this land, because if you controlled the trade routes through this tiny country, you controlled the trade routes all the way around the Mediterranean Sea. Now, would that be important to you? Yes, Terry? Which Solomon did. He surely did. And on imports into your country for sale. That's right. So as we look at these features, now this map I've put up here because it's simply bigger. You see the way of the sea and how it goes up through here and across through Phoenicia. It also forks right here and goes up toward Damascus. The way of Shur goes up through the high country, crossing the Jordan River, and likewise up toward Damascus. And then you have the King's Highway that goes on the east side of the Jordan and goes up toward Damascus. Now, we're not going to talk in this study about the importance of Damascus, but you see on the map that it would obviously become a very important place. Megiddo. Does that ring any bells to you? Armageddon. Does that ring a bell to most all of you? We often think of the Battle of Armageddon. Well, sometimes we think of that, folks do, as some kind of a future thing that's going to come to pass at the second coming of the Lord. In fact, I had a fellow student in a college class that was so excited about that she could hardly sleep at night, thinking that this was something that perhaps she was going to live through, when she did not understand that the place on the map is called Megiddo, and it was a very important place for battle to control this land. And you can see why. What did the trade route do right here at Megiddo? It was a crossroads. You see Mount Carmel and the higher area here, and so right through this little valley was a major to-do, going north and south, east and west. And so that becomes very significant. If you own that part of real estate, you owned that part of the world. Now, here is a much larger map. Here's the Mediterranean Sea over here. Asia Minor over here. Mesopotamia. Here's the Arabian Desert. Here's Egypt down here. When you look at the Arabian Desert, not a very desirable place to travel, is it? When you look east of that, you have Assyria, Media, Elam, and Persia. These ring familiar, certainly, in our minds. But to go anywhere, you have to go through here. Anywhere, you have to go through there. If you're coming from Asia Minor, you have to travel south through Canaan. If you're going to Africa, you have to go through Canaan. If you're traveling into the Arabian Desert, going south east, you have to travel through Canaan, and particularly so if there are imports coming into the city of Tyre that are going to be transferred in this direction, or for that matter in any direction, you have to go through the land of Canaan. Now, though it was a tiny little country, this was the land that was promised unto Abraham. Open your Bible to Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. Joseph, this is the land that we're talking about in our study, Genesis chapter 15. If you'll note in Genesis chapter 15, it tells us in verse 18, "In that day Jehovah made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite." Look up here. From the river of Egypt down here to the river Euphrates up here. This is going to be yours. You see how strategically located that was? 150 miles long till about 50 miles wide. This was to belong to the people of God. God selected this land. And you see why. Now that raises some interesting questions regarding climate. We say, well, what in the world does that have to do with Bible study? Well, it does, simply because when we see the different locations, we see the problems and the pleasantries that that often presented for God's people. Joppa, located on the coast, what would you believe the average temperature to be? Very similar to our coast. It would be about 67 degrees. Jerusalem was about 63 degrees average temperature. Yes, they had some winter time. But they also had some warmer weather. And why was Jerusalem about the same temperature as the coast? Well, keep that question in mind. The Jericho or Jordan Valley was only about 15 miles east of Jerusalem, but the average temperature there got up to at least where the high might be 110 degrees. You wouldn't find that in Jerusalem, and certainly not on the coast, but we're talking about an area that's about 50 miles wide. And we have such extremes in climate. Now that may cause you to ask the question, why is that so? Well, when you look at Joppa, of course, it's at sea level. And when you look at Jerusalem, it's about 3,000 feet high. And then when you look at the Jordan Valley, we note that it was about 825 feet below sea level. What a drop in elevation. And then when you come up on the Transjordan side, you're looking at, again, a plateau that's about 3,000 feet high. Would you find the temperature here about the same as Jerusalem, which is about the same as sea level? Well, the difference being elevation and the breeze from the cool sea. Terry? Jerusalem from the coast, I'm just going to guess by looking at the scale of miles up here in the neighborhood of, well, about 30 miles, because from Jerusalem to the Jordan Valley was about 15 miles. So that would put it at about 30 or so miles. No mountain ranges, no. No. That is correct. That is correct. And so this is the area that God gave unto Abraham. Now, interestingly enough, when you go to the north, you can't see this very well on your map, but to the north, and let me put that one back up, to the north up here, you have Lake or Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon reached a very high elevation, similar to the mountains that we fish in, of over 9,000 feet. And when you get up to that kind of elevation, you would find places that very well might have snow on them year-round. Mount Hermon, the Jordan River Valley, drops 10,000 feet in 120 miles from Mount Hermon to the Dead Sea. Would you expect to find the Jordan River to be quite swift? Now, why would you think that to be so important? Turn in your Bible to Joshua chapter 4, chapter 3 and 4. Joshua chapter 3 and 4. In Joshua chapter 3, they're making preparations to go into the promised land. Into the promised land. And if you would please, look at Joshua chapter 3, beginning in verse 5. Joshua chapter 3, verse 5. It says, "And Joshua said unto the people, Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow Jehovah will do wonders among you." In verse 10, it says, "And Joshua said, Hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanite, the Hivite, the Hittite, and the Hivite, and the Perizzite, and the Girgashite, and the Amorite, and the Jebusite." Now, these were the peoples living in the lands. How will you know that God will drive them out? Look, if you will, beginning at verse 13. "And it shall come to pass, when the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of Jehovah, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, even the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand in one heap." What is it that God is promising through Joshua unto the people of God? A miracle. Going to stop the river. Stop the river. Look, if you will, at verse 14. "And it came to pass, when the people removed from their tents to pass over the Jordan, the priests that bear the Ark of the Covenant began, or being before the people, and when they that bear the Ark of, were come unto the Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, for the Jordan overfloweth all its banks all the time of harvest, that the waters which came down from above stood and rose up in one heap a great way off at Adim, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those that went down toward the sea of the Arabah, even the Salt Sea," that's the Dead Sea, "were wholly cut off, and the people passed over, right against Jericho. And the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of Jehovah stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel passed over on dry ground, until all the nations were passed clean over the Jordan." Now, as you read in that text, and note that we're talking about a river that drops 10,000 feet in a very short distance. A river that this text tells us was in its flood stages. And Joshua said, you're going to know that God is going to deliver the nations that inhabit this land into your hand. How are you going to know that? It ought to be obvious. Any God that could stop the Jordan River in its flood stage, that drops 10,000 feet, that is so swift in its flood stage, and God will stop it still, so that over 2 to 3 million people could cross over on dry ground, and this would occur instantly when the priest who carried the Ark of the Covenant, when their feet touched the edge of the water. Now, God who could do that, would you think then that he would have any problem delivering the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, and so forth into your hand? Will you know that there is a living God, underscore that, among you who could do such things? That's right. That's right. That's right. And Joshua tells them that. That's why the stones were picked up to make a pillar there in Gilgal. Drop down to the 4th chapter and let's read beginning in verse 20. Joshua chapter 4, verse 20. It says, "And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan did Joshua set up in Gilgal. And he spake unto the children of Israel, saying, When your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean these stones? Then ye shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land. For Jehovah your God dried up the rivers of the Jordan from before you, until ye were passed over, as Jehovah your God dried up the Red Sea, which he dried up from before us, until we were passed over, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of Jehovah, that it is mighty, that ye may fear Jehovah your God forever. Now let me ask you, beloved, when we read Joshua chapter 3 and Joshua chapter 4, does it help you to understand what Joshua is saying when you know that from Mount Hermon to the Dead Sea was a 10,000 foot drop, and it was during the flood stage that Israel crossed over? Just a little tidbit of information that makes these two chapters enormous, doesn't it? When we see what God can do, we ought to be impressed with that. When we look at the Dead Sea, 1,292 feet below sea level, the stones? No. No. These were big enough to make a pillar that would be recognized as, you say, a conversation piece. And from what I understand, this was not an unusual thing to do, because pillars of stones were historically used to mark important places. It was a matter of cultural use. They would mark a place. It became a memorial. And so, yes, it wouldn't be a small stone. It would be stones big enough to be stacked into a pillar that would be recognizable. I think that's important. And Gilgal was very important, too. This was the place where Saul was appointed king. This was a place where, when David was driven out of the city of Jerusalem by his son Absalom, this was the place where David was brought back after Absalom was killed, brought back through Gilgal to take his place on the throne once again in Jerusalem. So Gilgal was not an insignificant place. And so when the children would ask, "What meaneth these pillar of stones?" it would be a place they were very much likely to see, to prompt that question. Of course, the answer was not just, "This is where we came in." It was to demonstrate the great things that God has done. Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, and wide enough, certainly, for 2 to 3 million people to pass. That's right. That's right. That's right. We're not talking about something that took 3 months to do. Now, that ought to impress them. It ought to impress the nations that knew what they were doing. And of course, as the spies came into the city of Jericho, Rahab knew. She knew what God had done. And she was terrified. Now, once again, you can't see this very well on this map. Richard's working on that, aren't you, Richard? To see if we can't get a little bit better picture here. But this is the area that is around the Dead Sea. Just barren, barren nothing. In fact, I don't know if many of you, no doubt, have been up to Mono Lake. And we know that there are not fish in the lake. Why?
Very salty.
Very salty. What about the Dead Sea? Very salty. And of course, you find it so far down below sea level, you would also find it to be very hot. Okay? All right, Randy? Yes. 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 In fact, let me find the place I want to be. Joshua chapter 2. Joshua chapter 2. That's not all that she's heard about. If you'll begin at verse 1. It says, "And before they were laid down, she came up unto them upon the roof, and she said unto the men, I know that Jehovah hath given you the land, and that the fear of you is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you, for we have heard how Jehovah dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, unto Sihon and to Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more spirit in any man because of you. For Jehovah your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, I pray you, swear unto me by Jehovah, since I have dealt kindly with you, that ye also will deal kindly with my father's house and give me a true token." So not only do we obviously know that they've heard what's happened regarding the Jordan, but even as far back as the parting of the Red Sea, those who are the inhabitants of Jericho and the surrounding land have heard about God. No, that's correct. That's right. That's right. So the people around this area, they've heard about God, and they know what He is able to do. Now, on page number 9, no it isn't, page number 7 of your lesson book. You might be able to see it clearer on your lesson book than you're able to see on this chart. But I want you to look carefully. This is a unique chart, and I worked real hard to get this up here where we could see it. Richard knows about that. But this line represents sea level. Can you see that from where you are? Here is Mount Hermon up here, just shy of 10,000 feet in elevation. Here is the Dead Sea down here, almost 2,000 feet, or as I believe we noted on the previous chart, over 1,000 feet in elevation, or below sea level. Now this tells us the drop of the Jordan River from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. We want to be impressed with that. Here's Mount Hebron, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives, and so forth, as you can see on your lesson book. But again, when you consider the drop in elevation from 10,000 feet to 1,200 feet below sea level, and consider it during the time of the flood stage when Joshua said, "You're going to see a mighty work. God is going to show you who He is. And you'll know that there is a God with you, and the nations round about will be impressed with what God has done." We need to be impressed with what God has done. Question or comment just here? Go ahead. I can see you're just itching to say something on this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. We're going to look at the travels of Abraham, the travels of Joseph, and several others on this this map, this geographic location. As we look at the topographical maps, I think we'll be even more impressed. That's quite a lot on foot. It sure is, especially as you grow older. Okay. Indeed. All right. I want to pursue on just a little bit, if I may. If you'll turn over the page to lesson number 3. Lesson number 3. Again, the geography of this small portion of land, the land of Palestine, on page number 8 in your lesson book. All right? For the purposes of our study, we're going to identify certain portions of this land that will be, I think, helpful to us. We're going to, of course, talk a great deal about the Mediterranean Sea, which, by the way, is referred to as the Great Sea. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to talk about the coastal plain. Can you see that along this area? Certainly in your lesson book you should be able to see that. And then we're going to be talking about the hill country where Jerusalem was located, about 3,000 feet in elevation. And then we'll be talking about the Jordan Valley, where we noted the temperatures may get up to 110 degrees. And then we'll be talking about the Transjordan Plateau that again gets up to about 3,000 feet in elevation. Now, that before you get to the area of the Arabian Desert, which, as we said, was not a very desirable place to be. But you also want to remember, when you think of the Arabian Desert, where did Paul go after he obeyed the gospel in Damascus? He went into Arabia, where he stayed for, 3 years before he came back to Damascus. So these places are real places, and the geography of them presents some interesting challenges to our study. Here is a topographical map that might be helpful to you. And again, Richard, if we could see this a whole lot better, it would be more better, as you say. But you see the coastal plain here, and I want you to see the mountains here, and then the Jordan Valley here, and the Transjordan Plateau here. Now, when we talk about places, that's going to be significant because you'll want to know where they're located in reference to each other and in reference to elevation. That all has a part to play in our study. Now, why is that so important? Well, I put this map on our list. This is not in your lesson book, at least not here, because this map displays this area during the time of the Roman Empire. Now, one of the things we've noted earlier is that the maps, as far as the land is concerned, it doesn't change. But the geographical boundaries do. And this particular map is designed to display the area that Rome controlled during New Testament times and shortly thereafter. Randy? Political boundaries. Yeah, these change. The geographical boundaries don't. The Mediterranean Sea is still here. The Black Sea and the Red Sea, they're still there. The coastlines, they haven't changed, but the political boundaries have, and we're going to see significant change in political boundaries as we study the biblical text. This is in the New Testament time, and you can begin to read about this in Luke in chapter 1 or Matthew chapter 1, where we note that the Caesars were in power, and that's significant to our study because we know the prophecy of Daniel was that from Babylon there would be 4 world empires. Daniel chapter 2, beginning with King Nebuchadnezzar, and then the Medes and the Persians, and then the Alexandrian or the Greek Empire, the intertestamental period of time, and then the New Testament as we began describing the Roman Empire. Now here's Canaan right over here. You see that? Right over here. Here's the Arabian Desert. Nobody wants that, you see. But here's Canaan. Now, if Rome, way over here, can control this area, including Canaan, around the Mediterranean Sea, what do they control? All of it. You know, this is all the known world that can be productive. Rome has it. And so, even as far as our Old Testament study, when we talk about the Assyrians coming in, when we talk about the Babylonians coming in, when we talk about the Medes and the Persians coming in, we see why. And so the geography of this takes on more meaning when we see and understand these locations. Now, the Great Sea. It's not referred to in the scriptures, to my knowledge, as the Mediterranean Sea. It's referred to as the sea, or the Great Sea. As Joshua is about to take these people in, after the death of Moses, in Deuteronomy chapter 34, Moses dies, and in Joshua chapter 1, I want you to begin reading in verse 1. Joshua chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "Now it came to pass, after the death of Moses, the servant of Jehovah, that Jehovah spake unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, to you have I given it, as I spake unto Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your border." Now do you see, define the land that God has promised to give unto Joshua and the people of Israel. We note then that the Mediterranean Sea during New Testament times is referred to as the center of the Roman Empire. You see why? Trade went across the Mediterranean Sea. Anybody who had anything, who had any dealings with Rome, knew what it was to travel the Mediterranean Sea. Now that's why the sea is the center of the Roman Empire. Now, as Joshua is writing, and as God tells Joshua in this text, he identifies this land from the wilderness, that would be on the east, and this Lebanon, the Lebanon Mountains on the coast, unto the great river, the river Euphrates on the northeast, all the land of the Hittites, unto the going, unto the great sea, that's the Mediterranean Sea, the going down of the sun shall be your border. Now, that's not hard to see the location if you look on these maps. The Mediterranean Sea, located on this map, referred to as the Great Sea. Now, that becomes important to us because south of Mount Carmel, I'm anxious to talk about Mount Carmel. South of Mount Carmel, there really wasn't any real good seaports or harbors. Now certainly north of there you had Joppa, and you had Joppa and Dor. Now Joppa is referred to in Jonah chapter 1 as being the place that Jonah went to board the ship to go to Tarshish to be away from God, so he wouldn't have to go to the city of Nineveh and cry out against the Ninevites. But the port in Joppa and Dor, as some have said, were not really sufficient to be called ports. So there really wasn't sufficient ports in this portion of the country. The Philistines inhabited the southern portion of this country on the coastal plain, and some have supposed, and likely so, that they came from the Isle of Crete to settle in this portion of Palestine. Now, later we're going to see that Herod decided that the southern portion of this particular land, if it was going to be productive as far as trade is concerned, that it needed to have a sufficient port. And so just out from this portion of the land, he made a harbor. And the city from the harbor was known as Caesarea, or Caesarea. And you see why. It was named for the Roman emperor by Herod the Great. Now, why is that important to our study? Well, look, if you will, those of you who have studied through some of this before, and in particular, those of you who have been in our Acts study. When we consider the travels of the Apostle Paul, here is his second preaching journey, New Testament times now, as he leaves from Antioch to Tarsus, up here to Lystra, to Troas, and then up into Macedonia, on down into Achaia, where Corinth is located. then comes across to the city of Ephesus, where he spends about 3 years, and then travels back to Jerusalem on his way back to Antioch, where he is to make his report to the church that sent him out. Now look at here. When he came down from Ephesus, where does he go? He goes to the harbor on a ship built by Herod, or the harbor built by Herod the Great. He goes to Caesarea. And then from there, the text tells us, he goes up to Jerusalem. Why is that important, Randy? He goes up to Jerusalem in elevation. Caesarea, here, sea level. Jerusalem, about 3,000 feet in elevation. So he goes up to Jerusalem from this seaport that was built by Herod the Great. Now, when you look at the second or the third preaching tour, look again. He goes out from Antioch to Tarsus to Lystra, up through Ephesus, on up into Macedonia, coming down again to Corinth in Achaia. And then, instead of coming across to Ephesus, he's learned of a plot to kill him, so he goes back up through here, comes to Miletus, doesn't stop at Ephesus, goes on down to Tyre on a ship, then to Ptolemais, and then to Caesarea, where he gets off the boat and goes to Jerusalem. Now, what I want to suggest to you in this study is, as we introduce these things, that the location of them makes the places come alive. It helps the events to have meaning to us as we see the significance of this tiny little place. Now, on his journey to Rome, those of you who are studying with us in the book of Acts and the study of the promise, know that when Paul was arrested here in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 21, he was arrested by Sergius Paulus. Remember? Okay? He was arrested by Sergius Paulus. He was in Jerusalem for a while. And there was a plot. 40 men entered into that vow that they were going to kill Paul, and they would neither eat nor drink till they had accomplished it. I imagine they got hungry, don't you? Because Sergius Paulus, no, not Sergius Paulus, Claudius Lysias, did I say Sergius Paulus a while ago? Claudius Lysias, who had arrested him in Jerusalem, then takes him to Caesarea, under guard, if memory serves me correctly, of about, was it in the neighborhood of 200 or 400 soldiers? Somebody check that for me. That would be Acts chapter 24, I believe. Takes him to Caesarea, where there he is imprisoned for a period of time, and he appears before Festus, and then before King Agrippa in Acts chapter 20, Felix, Festus, and Agrippa. Felix, Festus, and Agrippa. And then he is taken, according to his appeal, on this journey to Rome. And of course, that involves a whole lot of things relative to the geography as it pertains to the shipwreck and his arrival in Rome, where he then writes the four prison epistles, part of which we have been studying in our lessons on Wednesday night as we've studied the book of Ephesians. Now, once again, on this chart, we see simply a larger map, kind of a zoom in, to help us to see these places. Caesarea over here, and then, of course, the Mediterranean Sea and Rome off up yonder, and Asia way off up here somewhere. Okay? And then as we turn the page in our lesson book just a little bit further, we want to talk about the coastal plain. Our map simply turned around. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. The coastal plain, for our purposes, is divided into three divisions. We have identified the trade route, the way of the sea, and it goes up through this plain of Phoenicia. You see Phoenicia up here at the top, where you see Tyre and Sidon, where the very poor seaports were. Can you see that from where you are? All right. Phoenicia. The Canaanites were, for the most part, living in this area. The plain of Sharon. The plain of Sharon. I have a note here that I want to pick up. Let me turn the page. The plain of Sharon. Here it is. was about 45 miles long. The plain of Sharon, from here to here, the plain of Phoenicia, was probably something in the neighborhood of 40 miles long. And then from about Joppa, south, we talk about the plain of Philistia. From Joppa south, about 45 miles long. Now again, we're not talking about a very large distance east to west, but you see at the southern portion, it's greater than it is at the northern portion. Now again, geography. It has a great deal to do with many of the points that we're going to make. When God brought the people into this land, how was it described? How was it promised? As a land that what? Flows with milk and honey. It was described as a land that was extremely productive. Now, what do you need to be extremely productive? Good soil and water. That's right. We said here's the high country, the hill country, reached up to about 3,000 feet in elevation. Here's sea level. Now, I don't know why, but when we look at rivers and streams coming like this from the large body of water, we sometimes think, well, they're going this way. No, they're not going this way. They're going from the hill country into the sea. And in process, what are they passing? The plains. The very fertile plains. Yes. Terry? All right. That's right. All right. Add to that the promise of the Lord to the apostles in Acts chapter 1. Ye shall be my witnesses. Where? In Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the world. We're going to talk about that. Got a chart on it way down the pike here somewhere. Yes. Lots of them. All right, we'll have to stop there, and we'll pick up with some of that in our next episode.